You are listening to the Diesel Powered Podcast, the voice of Dieselpunk, brought to you by Comic Bento. Get a mystery box of comics and graphic novels in your mailbox every month. $50 worth at least, guaranteed, for less than 20 bucks. Visit mycomicbento.com for more. Also brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook on us at audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast. And now, it's time for the Agent Carter Roundtable.
Hey there, all you guys and gals, you hip cats, cool kittens, you diesel-powered disciples of cool. This is the Diesel-Powered Podcast, the voice of Dieselpunk on iTunes and Stitcher and all around the internet world. I am your host, the time-traveling comic book loving Dieselpunk prophet of pop culture, John Pica. Some of you know me as Big Daddy Cool, Johnny Della Rocca, swinging solid with me via the magic of the internet all the way from Memphis, Tennessee, is that darling damsel of the skies, Daisy O'Dare.
Good evening, sheiks and shapers. How are you this lovely evening?
I am just swell. How's that?
Well, it's good to be swell.
Yes, also joining us from New Orleans, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Ken Sharkey.
Greetings and salutations, everyone.
Greetings and salutations to you. And the man who is about to be a former Floridian, going back to the frozen tundra of Michigan, author of Dragonfly, Mr. Charles A. Cornell.
Good evening. Marvelous to be here.
It is marvelous to be here, and as we're talking about Marvel, we're talking about Marvel's Agent Carter. This is the Agent Carter Roundtable here on the Diesel Powered Podcast, and we are once again doing a two-parter, and once again, we have an extra long episode tonight, because we're actually covering two episodes, The Edge of Mystery, and what was the second one called? I'll have it here in front of me. A Little Song and Dance. Yeah, so knowing that it was going to be about 2 days after I watched this before we do this show, I took Ken's lead and I took notes.
Oh no!
Yeah, you know what? I have something to admit. I am the world's worst note taker. I'm terrible at taking notes. It's like the bane of my existence. So, yeah, they love me at work after I've had a conference call. But anyway.
I'm honored I could be such an influence on you, Johnny.
Well, you know. So, let's see. What do we got here? Oh, hey, before we get into this episode, see, I play it on Hulu while we're doing the podcast. Mm-hmm. And there's some commercial with... This chick looks like she needs to eat a hamburger. Maria, I don't know who that is. Anyway.
You know, people are all built different ways.
Yeah, but, you know, there's healthy skinny, and then there's, you know, I don't know. Anyway, so here we are. Our last episode had Whitney Frost absconding with Dr. Wilkes, and Anna Jarvis getting shot, going to the hospital, and the last scene we see is Peggy and Jarvis sitting on the bench in the hospital. It was this series, Empire Strikes Back, and that's where we pick up this episode. Everything has gone to hell.
As it should be. as it should be. That's the arc that there's usually a four-part arc in a story, and we're at the third arc. This major setback, the big bad takes over. Will our heroine prevail?
Yeah, and you know, it's a little bit different from season one, because in season one, the Empire Strikes Back moment was Agent Dooley throwing himself out the window to save everyone from the bomb vest. And that was shocking, and that was, you know, horrible, but it didn't have the same feeling of desperation that this last episode had going into this week's two-parter.
And we talked last week about all the various character arcs and the subplots needing resolution. We kind of listed them all down here, and this is the point where it starts this episode, where all those questions remain, like how are they going to tie it all in? It's much more, if you think about last season, this is a much more complex plot, you know, in terms of the characters and their interaction. You've got more characters, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
We all had questions about our favorite ones and whether they were coming back and what their role would be.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things I liked the most about this episode was the way that it started. Mm-hmm. Tying in this season with season one with that flashback. And I always love this, Ken, when movies or TV shows or even stage productions give you a peek behind the scenes of a scene that you've already seen.
Yeah, no, this was great, because we had seen the scene that was playing out from the point of view of Peggy and a little bit of Jarvis. And you know, you actually hear Anna's voice in the background. You never see her, you never saw her the first season. And they kind of explained why we didn't see her during the scene while he was supposed to be at home. And I thought it was nicely done.
Yeah, it really was. It was nice to see that flashback, that callback, and you know, kind of seeing Anna sanctioning Jarvis's missions from the very beginning. Because you remember in season one how we kind of got this feeling like maybe he was keeping something from her, because we didn't see her, and the way he talked about Miss Jarvis and having to be home at a certain hour and whatnot, it made it feel like and sound like maybe she was either in the dark or not approving. But Daisy, we see right here right off the bat that she was behind Jarvis going on these adventures from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. She was. And it's good to see, you know, her conscious and talking, and it's good to see her being supportive of him, because she knows that she can't understand everything he does. She can't be a part of what he does sometimes, but she's going to support him 100%. I think they have a good picture of a good, solid marriage, I would say.
Well, yeah, and we're going to expand on that thought later on as we get deeper into this episode. But, you know, there's some byplay between Peggy and Jarvis. He's really disheveled. She wants him to look his best, brings him a change of clothes, his shave razor, some, you know, toiletries and whatnot. But that's really setting up his character arc through this episode. But, you know, Ken, last week you talked about noticing Whitney Frost talking to herself. But here in the second scene, where she's got Dr. Wilkes held hostage, we find out she's not the only one who hears the voices.
Well, she is initially, but that's also because she's accepted her fate and you know, is using what's happened to her advantage, whereas Wilkes has been fighting it, you know, trying to get rid of it the entire time. So she's far more attuned at this point. But yeah, I mean, it's like we pointed out, you know, where she was talking to herself in bed, and then the scene that we saw her talking to herself in the mirror, she's obviously communicating, or something is communicating with her. What that is, I'm extremely excited to find out. I wonder if it's a big Marvel baddie, you know, that has yet to make an appearance in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I don't know. It's pretty exciting. And then her, you know, trying to convince Wilkes, you know, as two scientists together, they should be working together. And you know, her initial, you know, trying to explain the voices was kind of funny, because you know, she's like, you know, do you hear it too, or am I just going crazy? And he kind of looks at her and goes, kind of shakes his head, like, yeah, you're nuts. But I think he also realizes that there's definitely a value in listening to what she has to say. So
yeah, I mean, this I got a feeling they hired some scriptwriter who was maybe an editor in Donald Trump's Art of the Deal, because we've got so many bargains going on between characters in this whole series. And here's one scene with her bargaining with Wilkes to bring him onto her side. We'll see much more of all the skullduggery and deal-making that goes on between the other characters later on as well. But, you know, the idea about them linked, he now has a reason to – there's something about how she could pull him back from I don't know what you call it. What's the uber geek word for it, Ken? Where he's gone, right? He gone beyond the point of no return, right? And she can pull him back, you know, and then there's this little time clock going about how many seconds or minutes that he's got left. And she's using that as a tool to bargain with him.
Yeah, well, she's obviously, while he was unconscious, I mean, she basically says it. She's been examining him, experimenting, and she alludes to the fact that she's also been transferring some of the dark matter from her to him as part of the, you know, part of the evaluation that she's been doing. Because, you know, at the very end of the first scene of them together, she basically starts to lift her hand to Wilkes, you know, and it's obvious that, you know, she's going to transfer more dark matter to him in order to keep him solid. So it's interesting, because it's that, you know, we have a common bond. You're not so much right now the guinea pig. We need to, you know, put our brilliant minds together. But you also, and John, I'm sure you'll appreciate this, the slow convincing of him to possibly join the dark side.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I also got the sense, and you know, maybe this is reading too deep into it, but you know, it's interesting. But these are the kind of conversations the scientists probably had when they were doing the Manhattan Project. You think of this time period, right? You know, here's these scientific brains, and it's like, well, should we really do this or shouldn't we? And what's the best interest of mankind? And are we going to unleash something that we can't control? That whole thing with zero matter is very much, you know, it's a symbolic of that whole era as the rise of atomic power and the atomic bomb.
Well, it's kind of a side effect.
Well, it is, but what I'm saying is here's these two scientists you can imagine, you know, Oppenheimer talking to one of the other scientists saying, hey, look, we got to develop this bomb to defeat the Japanese. And this other person saying, well, yeah, but what are we going to do when we unleash this power on mankind? It's almost as if you've got this sort of scientific argument that sort of transcends ethics. You know, we have to do it in the name of science. And that's the kind of thing I got out of their conversation a little bit was, you know, Wilkes should, by all rights, have said, there's no damn way, you know. But he's a scientist, so he's being appealed to his scientific curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do we open Pandora's box or don't we?
Yeah, exactly. And what's the ethical consequence of doing that?
So my next notes just say Sousa. And that's all it says.
Well, we do have the next scene being Sousa out in front of Stark's house examining a dry pool of blood, and with a very worried look on his face, and then Peggy pulling into the driveway, explaining what happened the previous evening. You know, Sousa at first worrying that something had happened to her, and then, you know, Peggy mentioning that Anna had been shot. And what I really liked about this was you see, even though Sousa hasn't had a lot of interaction with Anna, the fact that Peggy was like, you know, she was shot, or, you know, she just says Anna Jarvis, his first reaction is like, oh crap. And, you know, she has to, you know, Peggy says quickly, you know, she's in the hospital. She survived. But, which I thought was a nice little touch to show, again, the really human side of Sousa, that, you know, no matter who it is, he worries and cares. And then it switches to Carter basically noticing that Sousa had been roughed up, and, you know, Sousa mentioning that, well, some of Vernon's boys, you know, paid me a visit, so.
Well, and they go into this conversation, and this was a really great little conversation about Manfredi and uh-huh. his relationship with Frost, you know, taking place in Peggy's boudoir. And Daisy, I don't know if you caught this, but when Peggy asks Sousa to turn around, she's actually in the other room, but he still has to turn around. And they're on the chair or the bidet or whatever it was one of Peggy's garter belts. And that was enough to fluster him.
Well, Sousa strikes me as sort of an upright kind of guy when it comes to that kind of matters. You know, he strikes me as, you know, probably a guy who would be a gentleman. And we know he really likes Peggy. And sometimes, you know, you get a little flustered when you're reminded, hey, this is a human being, and sometimes they wear underwear or even less. Oh my goodness, I saw her underwear. Woo.
I can relate to him in that respect.
I figured you could.
Yeah, no, just a great
conversation. Speaking your language.
Yeah, no, it was a great scene, though. I will tell you this, that Peggy Carter takes longer to get undressed than any other person in the free world. During that entire conversation, the only thing she took off was her jacket. But they immediately figure out that they need to go find Manfredi, that he's the connection to Frost, and they visit him at, I guess it's his restaurant or his mother's restaurant, and here we get this great scene.
I love that little old lady.
In the Italian kitchen. And, you know, I grew up in just south of Cleveland, Ohio, Akron, Ohio. We had Italian restaurants on every corner, kind of like churches in Nashville. I mean, they were just everywhere. And this is how those Italian restaurants were. Mama was in the back, and, you know, one of the sunny boys was, you know, helping out or working the front, or, you know, business manager, something in that regard. And just just a great, great picture, I thought.
Well, this whole scene's been turned upside down. Throughout these next two episodes were some of the best writing that they've done, because they've taken what you expect to happen and surprised you. You expected when they walked in their restaurant and asked for them that he would just come out and talk to them. But oh no, that's not going to be that simple in Agent Carter. He's going to be back doing the cooking while his mother's arguing about the ingredients, and then she's got to get through his goons to him. And what perspective, what camera angle did we see? Right, we saw the camera angle from the kitchen out into the restaurant through the glass door, and all we see is bodies flying across the door as Peggy takes care of business. Brilliantly constructed. I mean, that's not what we would have expected.
Well, and juxtaposed against the argument, the air quotes argument between Manfredi and his mother.
I just love how she would speak Italian and he would answer in English, so you could just imagine what all she was saying.
Well, and growing up in that culture, that's how it was. The older generation, the people from the old country, spoke the language, but mm-hmm. the kids were always too lazy to really learn it conversationally. They couldn't bother, they couldn't be bothered. Business was done in English. They learned English. They didn't worry about, learning the old language. Right. So he may not have known very much Italian.
So he was just trying to guess by the way she was acting.
Well, no, he knew what she was saying, but I mean, he may not have known really how to have that conversation in Italian.
Yeah, the culture. I grew up in a multicultural city, a steel town in Canada, and we had all different nationalities. And that was the way that the kids wanted to divorce them. They wanted to become it was in Canada, but Americanized, I guess. They wanted to speak English. They didn't want to be associated with the old country. They wanted to be American. And so that was what they would do. And a lot of the times they would switch back and forth. And when things got heated, that's when they would turn to their other language, right? If you were with them, and an argument, a family argument started, that they wouldn't embarrass themselves in front of strangers or friends of family who weren't native speakers. They'd go into their language and have the argument out, and it's like, and then they'd look at you just the way Manfredi does, sort of like, it's okay, everything will be just fine. Yeah, she picked up a knife. It's no big deal. She does it all the time, And I know where he's got his psychopathic tendencies. They're inherited from his mother.
Yeah, but didn't you find it really kind of cool? Here he is face to face with his enemies, because they're the enemies of his girl, but he's still playing the good host.
Yeah, gives him a bowl of spaghetti.
Well, Sousa gets a bowl of spaghetti. Mama thinks Peggy's the devil.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. That was kind of weird. But, they didn't get through much.
She makes the horns at her and spits and everything.
Yeah.
Does not like Peggy being there.
Well, yeah. I mean, after all, he's the good host because they are in his house.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's that. Again, it's that old custom of, you're in my house. As long as you show respect, I show respect. But as long, and once you step out of line,
all bets are off. Yeah. So my next note just says Thompson, or no, it says Drunk Thompson.
Ah,
yes. Oh, this was great.
Flashback to London.
Well, take it, Daisy.
Was it a flashback? No. He was in London.
It wasn't a flashback, no. He was in London, Sorry.
Okay. He was in London, and he was meeting up with a college friend he had there, because they were kind of stumbling through the streets drunkenly singing some alma mater song. And this contact apparently worked for the SOE or had access to their files, because he gives Thompson a file on Peggy Carter.
I believe he was MI6.
Okay.
But
he involved in that.
But yeah, he does find the file of Peggy in the SOE. But yeah. So basically, Thompson has gone to England to talk to one of his old college buddies from Cornell, and, you know, apparently are pub hopping. And, you know, before they go in for the next round, he asks his old buddy if he had brought the goods. And his friend mentions that he had to break a lot of security protocols, but had found what Thompson was looking for.
Yeah, and, you know, isn't it fun how they juxtaposed this, you know, spy subterfuge kind of thing against an old college reunion, and, you know, his friend says, "Hey, I know why you're really here. You're not fooling me. Mm-hmm. You want to try and take down my drinking record."
Yeah. Yeah.
And just a real fun scene. And, of course, Thompson wasn't drunk at all. And here we get another piece of your amazing adventures technology. Charles, the reader, I don't even know what you call it, that lets him read through the blacked out ink.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's spy tech that probably exists today.
Probably.
Yeah. But it's certainly helpful to move the story along.
Yeah, and that's where we see that it's a file about Agent Carter.
Now, do we know what the file... I mean, it's obviously a redacted file, and they make mention that it has to do with a situation that took place while Peggy was in the war in 1944, but do we know exactly what the file is, or are we kind of left in the dark?
I got the impression that, you remember in season one, they had this issue about some massacre in, I don't know whether it's Poland, or it had involved the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I wondered if that was part of that incident, because they arrived afterwards, and there's a whole, that never got resolved in season one. We never really knew what happened there. But it created the bad guy that, you know, was sort of the handler for Dottie Underwood.
Well, I thought that was where they released that that psychotropic gas.
That's right. Yeah.
And they all turned against right. each other. But
right.
you know, in the file that he read, it said, you know, nobody was spared, or not one life was spared. And then the next line you see, what is it? SAO. Agent
SOE.
SOE agent what's her real name? Margaret Carter?
Yeah.
Peggy Margaret in British. That's what the British call Peggy Margaret.
Yeah.
Peg.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, this was something that Thompson went after, you know, he's acting the way Vernon wants him to. You know, Vernon gave him orders to dig up the dirt to destroy Peggy. So obviously that's what this is.
Yeah, we may find out if there's a season three. Maybe we'll find out more.
Maybe. Maybe. Now, I love in the next scene where Wilkes is reading through Peggy's... or not Peggy, through Whitney's experiment journal. And she asked, "What do you think of my research?" And he says, I see that you're a mass murderer of rats.
Yeah. That's a good line.
Yeah, it was a really good line. And, you know, she talks about how, yeah, it's rudimentary, but it's taught me how to control this, and you can control it too.
Yeah, and she starts with the voices again, and, you know, talking about how it's there, like, sort of like in the background, but still speaking to her, and basically starts to coach Wilkes to, you know, block out all the noise around him so that he can tune into the voice as well. And that's when Manfredi interrupts them with his charm and, you know, gets a kiss on the cheek and, you know, sweetie baby and all that stuff to Frost, and basically, you know, delivers a message to her from Carter.
Well, yeah, and this is where we find out that Peggy is willing to do a trade. Mm-hmm. Willing to trade what Whitney wants the most, the uranium rods, in exchange for Wilkes, unharmed. And, yeah, tell Miss Carter she's got a deal, Whitney says. And the die is kind of cast at that moment. And then we flash back to the hospital with Jarvis and Anna, and she finally comes around. She finally wakes up.
But even before that, I have to say that before she wakes up and Jarvis is basically, you know, promising to wear the knit tie that she made him, you know, to get them a Burmese mountain dog. Also, you know, he's just making promise after promise after promise. But I've got to say that this small scene of him over her bed, probably some of the best acting he has done. Yeah. I mean, it was.
Yeah, I was really going to say the same thing too.
Yeah, it was just.
He's a serious dramatic actor, and when I saw him cast as Jarvis, and Jarvis is wasn't my most popular favorite character in series one. He's a little better this series, but I was quite disappointed in that they would waste his acting talent on that sort of comic role. Obviously wanted that challenge as an actor to do it, but this shows his dramatic side in all his glory. He's a serious dramatic actor. He plays a lot of roles in British television. We watch a lot of British television through Netflix, and you know, he shows up all the time with some very serious roles. He usually plays the bad guy. He's played a number of very bad killer types in British dramas.
Well, you know, watching him in this scene, he reminded me a lot of Timothy Dalton. And it just occurred to me, as I've got this playing in the background, he would make an exemplary James Bond. In the tradition of the Roger Moore, Timothy Dalton Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah, I can see him as that. I could actually see him probably more in the classic Sherlock Holmes kind of role. But again, back to the scene. This was probably the best interaction, especially between him and Anna, when she finally does come to, and you know, then he goes out and we see him on the phone with Peggy, and then the doctor comes out and delivers the devastating news that the doctor gives him. I mean, seeing him walk back in the door with his back to Anna so he can compose himself, and he turns around and, you know, he's happy, cheery Jarvis again, even though you catch tins of him fighting, you know, the devastation. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, it was just, you know, I could not have felt more for Jarvis at that point, you know, because of the brilliant acting than I did, you know?
Yeah, you know, I was expecting, and maybe I'm cold, or maybe I just don't understand this, but I was expecting, when the doctor said there were complications, for it to be something much more, I don't know, traumatic. I mean, that she was going to be paralyzed, or they had to take her legs, or, you know, something of that nature. And maybe it's just because, you know, I'm not a woman. I'm never going to be a mother. I have two kids, but, you know, I didn't give birth to them. I had a hard time really feeling the weight of that.
Well, here's the thing. They never talked about, before then, they didn't talk about having children. But for a lot of couples who hadn't discussed that yet, you know, they have, they still have the luxury to make the choice. Like, do we want to have kids or do we not want to have kids? And when something happens that takes away the ability to have kids, it's like that option is closed to you. No, they didn't talk as much about adoption back in that time, so it was a lot more, I mean, not that it isn't heartbreaking for women now, but back then, you know, adoption was not necessarily as encouraged, shall we say, as it is now. So I can kind of understand, because that is, you know, if a woman wants to have a child someday, you know, that's always a fear of theirs that they won't be able to have them at some point.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the crushing news that Jarvis has gotten, and he's going to be the one to tell Anna. And then we immediately flip back to Peggy and Dr. Samberly. He's back.
Oh, Samberly.
And
more annoying as ever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the interesting thing. So, Charles, we had been talking about how Jarvis has been the comic foil for most of the series.
Right.
But here, and in previous episodes, but especially in this episode, that role is now given to Samberly.
Right. And maybe it's because Jarvis's character arc has gotten so serious. I mean, there's no more playing around with the situation with his wife, and what he, you know, his motivation right now, as we find out later, as to what he wants to do. So clearly, yes, having that second character that can take that role on brings everything, you know, more the serious nature of the circumstances Jarvis finds himself in does not suit itself to comedy anymore.
I'm wondering, Ken, did you pick up on this? They're having a conversation, and then all of a sudden, Howard Stark's, what they called a telex, his fax machine, starts going off, and a fax comes through, and it just so happens to be the specifications for a gamma cannon that will neutralize zero matter.
Yes.
Now, how in the world did Howard Stark know they needed a gamma cannon?
I was wondering that myself, which tends to lead me to believe that Stark is monitoring the situation without having to be there personally.
Well, in the scene where Jarvis and Peggy are in the between the kitchen and the sitting room, mm-hmm. where the telex is, mm-hmm. there's a portrait of Howard Stark on the wall.
And we've talked about these portraits being almost in every single room.
Yeah. Just something I picked up on.
Howard's watching, or at least listening, maybe.
Yeah, it's a little problematic because the consequences of the Zero Matter are so, I mean, it's being positioned beyond the atomic bomb, right? And for someone like Stark, who's right now just playing, you know, movie producer, not to jump into an active role is a little bit counter to his character and the previous season, right?
Mm-hmm.
It seems just another device to move the story forward, as opposed to being a real life, like, because it raises a lot of questions, and we can analyze it in hindsight. It didn't, to me, it just sort of moved the story quickly to the next step. I was more interested in what was going to happen next and how they're going to get out of these predicaments. But then reflecting back, as you're saying, it's like, well, yeah, how did he know? You know, we haven't seen him for how many episodes now? When was the last time we saw Howard Stark?
I think the third episode.
Yeah, wasn't he filming some cowboy thing?
Well, that was the first episode, but...
Oh, was it? All right.
Or the second one. One of those.
When the last time we saw him. But anyway, yeah, so if he is monitoring it, you'd think he'd jump in and take a more active role. Things are getting pretty dire and pretty serious. The consequences of failure are certainly there.
Wasn't the last time we saw him, he was heading off to South America?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
He was going to Peru, wasn't he?
To Peru to meet with Abner... Abner, what was his last name?
The guy.
The Indiana Jones guy.
Hold on. Let's go through my notes here. I've written too much notes. Abner Brody.
Yeah, yeah. Because we talked in length about that being a nod to Indiana Jones. So they come up with this plot to hand over these fake uranium bars to Whitney, and by the time she would realize they're fake, they would have gotten Wilkes and gotten away with him in plenty of time. But you know, lucky for Manfredi and Whitney Frost, these are fake, because one of Manfredi's men doesn't handle these things too well.
Yes, but we've kind of jumped past a rather important scene.
Oh?
And that is Thompson confronting Peggy that he has a file.
Oh, yes, you're right, you're right.
Which to me was important because he didn't go straight to Vernon.
Oh, yeah, he brought it to her first.
Uh-huh.
Now, it did bother me that here he just shows up in Howard Stark's house.
Again, he has really bad security, man. I mean,
hey, look, I understand people are able to come and go from Howard Stark's estate as they want, but neither Sousa nor Peggy nor Jarvis says, hey, what are you doing here? Get the hell out.
Right. I know.
That bugged me.
There's quite a bit of little hiccups. I thought the character writing in these episodes were really well done. Acting was done very well. But there was small attentions to very important details that they seem to just kind of slide past, and this was kind of one of them. And again, you know, as Charles says, you know, this is definitely one of those where it was more of a to move the plot along type thing, because yeah, I mean, you have Thompson just sitting there calling them Larry Moe and Curly, and you know, Sousa just kind of walks off with Samberly, and it's like, no, I mean, he's obviously here for a reason. This, you know, he's not just going to be sitting in Stark's house. This is a potential threat, you know, and it's just Peggy who kind of handles it in her, you know, Carter charm. But it was odd to me.
Well, and Charles, here we got this great character moment with Peggy and Thompson. In particular, the way that Peggy reacted to this secret file and Thompson's apparent intention to use it.
Right, and what's interesting about these series of scenes in these next two episodes is that we get into, there's a lot of skullduggery, what I call skullduggery, right? Where, who's the bad guy, who's the good guy, which side are they on? You know, there's a lot of deception. And in a number of these scenes, the scene actually ends with Peggy Carter taking charge. And yeah, it's been designed that way for her character. I thought it was really good, actually. I mean, I'm applauding them, because she's clearly like in charge no matter what the hell's going on. And there's so much going on, and it's not confusing, but there's a lot of little things like, oh my God, they're going here, they're going there, they're going somewhere else, they've got to worry about this guy and that guy, and which side is Jack on and which side is Wilkes on and this and that. But at the end of the day, she comes in and says, I'm taking charge. And that was an I'm taking charge Peggy Carter moment. And I thought they did it really well.
Yeah, especially when you know, basically her final comment to Thompson is, you're better than this. And just gives him a half smile, yeah, and turns and walks away. And you can see right there Thompson like, damn. You know, she's, yeah, like, you know, like you're saying, Charles, she's in charge, you know, because it doesn't faze her. Oh, you've got a file on me that conveniently shows up as Vernon is trying to, you know, to find dirt on me and woo you into his, you know, into his thing. Yeah, okay, cool. But you know what? You're better than this. And in a way saying, I still believe in you, but you're wrong right here. So I'm going to go do what I need to do and, deal with that.
Yeah, we had a great line here, too, from Peggy, you know, when she says, you don't have to just accept whatever phlegm Vernon coughs up to a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Really great visual descriptive there.
And she tells him straight up, I am loyal to you, Thompson. I'm loyal to you. I'm still, you know, I'm still fighting the fight. I'm still trying to do what's right. You need to be the one to figure out in your own head what you need to do and what conflicts you need to resolve.
Right.
Yeah. So, thanks for catching that and not having us gloss over it. They make the exchange. Wilkes for the uranium bars, and in my notes I have Wilkes turns.
Mm-hmm. Again, in my notes, if you'll indulge me for a minute,
go for it.
There was a part to the scene that I found incredibly intriguing, and that's the fact that once again we see Frost wearing a scarf over her face, hiding the, you know, the cracking. And it's Manfredi, of all the men that she has dealt with, who basically, in a way, tells her she's beautiful for who she is. because of her strength. And I don't think he's talking necessarily about the strength of the fact that she's got these powers. But there's a moment there that I really respected Manfredi, because he was basically telling her, even though they're both incredibly evil, bad, you know, baddies, there was a moment there of pure, like, love that he, that of all the men that she has dealt with, you know, the crooked ex-husband, the swarmy movie executives and the producers and everything like that, it's this guy who has loved her unconditionally. And basically it's like, I love you because you are strong. And there was that moment where I was just like, I know you're the bad guy, but damn, dude, you kind of getting this right. I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
Well, he's the only bad guy who doesn't have an agenda of his own.
And it adds nuance to his character. You know, he's not just some cardboard bad guy. You see that he has a heart, basically.
Well, he's still a psychopath, and so is she.
Right, and I know.
Yeah, but in his own weird little way, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've got here is, what I saw from it anyway, was this, with this great, you know, love affair between two evil people. I mean, that to me is great, the way they scripted that, because you could take it on both levels. I mean, it kind of, in a way, there's a lot of these little vignettes that I think they've taken from the old-time movies of the 40s and 50s. I mean, that would be a love scene between who? You know, Humphrey Bogart and Katharine Hepburn, or, you know, here's looking at you, kid, kind of. That was the kind of scene it was. And they lifted it up to the level of two psychopaths that, you know, could have been, you know, at the top of any fascist organization of the time.
Well, more than that, they are making both of these characters very likable. I like Whitney Frost.
In a tragic way, yes.
Yeah, as a person, you know, as a character, I'm she's relatable, she's likable. And Manfredi, I think, is a very likable bad guy. And, you know, to me, the bad guys that are likable are the best. Because, you know, you can relate to them, and you can feel more in tune with them. Now, you were mentioning that scene between Manfredi and Whitney, Ken, and I did a quick search, because Veronica Lake is one of my all-time favorite Hollywood actresses, and there's a lot of Whitney Frost that reminds me of Veronica Lake.
Especially when she has to rearrange her hair.
Yes, and she had a kind of an on-screen relationship as playing femme fatale roles against Alan Ladd, who played these kind of tough guy noir roles. And that scene is almost shot by shot. I just lost it. The film is called, where is it? This Gun for Hire.
Huh.
Yeah. Interesting. Little homage there.
That's where I think they've done a really good job of having those kinds of interludes. And we're going to see a real major one at the beginning of the second episode of this two-part evening, right?
Oh, yeah.
When we talk about flashing back to the old-time movies. We'll get there.
Oh, yeah.
So Wilkes turns. He pulls the gun on Sousa and Peggy. He breaks free, and
that's one way to put it. he clearly showed that he can control his power now.
Yeah, he phases right through the side of the truck. And then, but, you know, leaving the shotgun behind, he's holding the shotgun, he phases through, the gun gets left behind, but then we see him solid again as he opens the door to get into Whitney's car.
Yeah. It reminded me of another Marvel character, Shadow Cat.
Yeah.
It was a very Shadow Cat type, you know, move that he did.
Yeah, the Kitty Pryde character, yeah.
Uber geek moment! Thank you.
Now, you want to talk about film noir. The next scene in Vernon's, now Vernon's office, formerly Seuss's office, between Vernon and Thompson. You've got, you know, the office at twilight, the street lights shining through the shutters, and this confrontation between Vernon and Thompson, where Thompson kind of figures it out. He listens in on the call, but before then he's kind of suspicious, and now he's having a crisis of conscience.
Yeah, I thought that was a great scene, because he Thompson kind of even mentions to Vernon how convenient this file seems to be, that it popped up with dirt on Peggy, because, you know, even beforehand, you know, he had called Peggy a Girl Scout, which was a great little nod to how everyone refers to Captain America as the ultimate Boy Scout. But the little interaction there, and then, you know, the phone call that Vernon obviously gets from Frost. You really start to see the wheels turning in Thompson's head, that and it's something that I had kind of, you know, mentioned in the past, that I was wondering if he was kind of playing the rogue agent to kind of get in deeper with Vernon. But you definitely see it solidify when he picks up the phone and he hears Frost's voice on the other line, and then we have the next scene with Vernon going into the lab. So
yeah, and this whole resolution, is he a bad guy, is he a good guy, is he going to come to Peggy's aid at the moment, the right moment, and her moment of need. We get the impression at this stage that he is a good guy, that this is his aha moment. But then that turns later, right? And we start to question him again.
Or at least we think it does. And
yes,
that's...
we do. That's right. The deception. It's just another smoke and mirrors episode, isn't it?
Well, it's all a big song and dance.
All a big song and dance, yep.
And yeah, we'll get to that in a moment. But you noticed, Charles, when Sousa and Peggy find Thompson in the lab, they find something on the floor.
yes, the little
the memory zapper doohickey.
The thing you get out of the Cracker Jack boxes.
We know that thing.
It's been used on Thompson.
Yeah, he gets zapped. That was a great little thing there, because I thought, now this is a turning point. You know, I was expecting Jack to be right on their side and do a mea culpa about how he's been wrong about Peggy all the time and blah, blah, blah. Well, he didn't remember any of it, because he got zapped by the little zapper things. And I thought, oh, my God, this is great. They're going to just play this out.
Well, he was able to kind of restore his memory somewhat when they walked through the bullpen, you know, searching for clues and
vague recollections, yeah.
And found something he had written to himself.
Right, right.
Does anyone remember what that was?
It was coordinates.
Yes.
Coordinates to they would be able to find Whitney Frost, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where they're going to do the bomb detonation.
The big boom.
And so we have Samberly has constructed the Gamma Cannon. This is where we're coming to the climax of the number, right? They're going out to set out the bomb. Samberly has completed the Gamma Cannon. They're going to go disrupt the detonation, supposedly. Thompson is all in with them. He's standing behind them. He's part of the team. And here we see Rose coming back into action, but not to go into the field, but to be Jarvis's surrogate at the hospital with Anna, because she has told him, your adventures are important, and Miss Carter needs you. She needs you more than I need you right now.
Well, I think at this point, though, and of course we're not entirely aware of it, you know, he's obviously a part of the mission, but there is a definite sign of this has now moved beyond Peggy relying upon him to Jarvis. Jarvis has something personal now in this. The way that he hands everything to Rose, you know, the cashmere blanket, Anna's favorite recipes, and then the white bundle that we don't initially see.
But we knew what it was.
We knew what it was, right. It's basically like a last will and a goodbye letter. But at that point, he's saying goodbye. And I actually found that particular scene probably to be probably one of the scariest scenes, because you see a man who has resolved that he is not coming back.
You've seen a big change in Jarvis.
Yeah. I mean, the look on his face, his interaction with Rose, even when Rose goes to hug him, he's still very cold. He's resolved that he is going to, by any means necessary, end Frost.
Right. It's a very, again, another dramatic scene in the character and the transformation of the character from the sort of jovial sidekick and kind of almost awkward in his actions to being very determined, very deliberate, very focused, and obviously on a mission that has the highest possible stakes for him personally and for the team. We don't know what he's going to do, but we know he's going to do something.
We know what he wants to do.
Yeah. We get a good suspicion of what he wants to do.
You know, I loved in that scene, too, where he's giving Rose kind of the commission here. Just before that, the exchange between Rose and Samberly, where she's asking him, is this Gamma Cannon going to work? And he says, which answer would you find more attractive?
Oh, Samberly.
He's got it bad for Rose.
Well, you know,
she
of course
makes good pie, and she can throw a mean punch.
That
Who
is,
would love yeah. Rose?
Reminds me a lot of you, Daisy.
I take that as a compliment.
Yes.
And I love the fact that he's like, well, you know, after I fixed Stark's specifications.
After I saved the day building the Gamma Cannon.
It's like, dude, shut up. Seriously, man. I mean, he's so lovable. And, you know, you're kind of like, wow, God, man. And I think all of us at some point has worked, you know, and a job with someone like him, where it's like, oh my God, you're so annoying, but I like you, but oh God, just shut up, please, just for a minute. Oh, all right, yeah, I like you, but I don't want to not like you, but yeah. So yeah, they've done well with the Samberly character, I've got to say. Well, and a quick note that just hit me too, Charles, you've mentioned how, you know, the actor that plays Jarvis is, you know, normally known for his serious roles. What's really interesting is that the actor that plays Manfredi is known for his comedic roles. So it's almost like the two actors have switched places.
Yeah. Yeah, this has been a big challenge for all of them, and then all of a sudden, at the beginning of the final pairing of these two episodes, they're going to get another chance to show their skills and talents.
Which
when I saw it was like, wow, this is great.
Well, and everything comes into a rolling boil here in the last 5 minutes of this episode. Peggy and team arrive on the scene just as the bomb is being detonated. And true to Whitney's predictions, her calculations are correct. It is an exact replica of the detonation that first opened the rift to zero matter. And we have the rift opened again. And what was interesting, though, is the zero matter this time didn't behave the way it did the first time. You remember in the film that they showed, the rift opened up, and then all of a sudden the zero matter became this black hole kind of vortex thing that sucked everything into it. And that didn't happen this time. Instead, it formed into an orb, black at the center, but with, you know, kind of that glowing corona. And as Whitney is thinking that she and Jason are going to become one with the zero matter, and whatever she thinks is going to happen doesn't happen. Wilkes is taken up into the air and drawn into the zero matter orb, while Whitney Frost is left distraught, screaming, "What about me? This is my moment. Take me." And she loses it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I thought interesting here is that this was not just a crack, this was not just a rift. This looked like a straight up like portal that had opened up, and I wish I had time, because I wanted to go back and look at the Avengers movie and see what that portal looked like. Because I was almost wondering if we were seeing like an early version of the
Tesseract.
Well, the opening that brought all the alien race down on New York.
Yeah, the Chitauri. No, it was a very different portal. Good thought, though. However, it wouldn't surprise me if this zero matter is one of the Infinity Gems.
Yeah, because I've been wondering, like, this voice that Frost is hearing, wouldn't it be an amazing tie-in if that's Thanos?
Ooh. I hadn't thought about that.
I mean, because we still have the Infinity War movies to look forward to that Marvel's going to be coming out with in the future.
Yeah.
So, sorry, uber geek moment.
Yeah.
And another thing that I wrote down in my notes is, was it me or did the Vernon and Manfredi and their crew look like they might be a tad too close to the blast? I know I'm nitpicking here, but isn't that supposed to be almost like a nuclear explosion?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit dangerous.
I was a little worried about them. But maybe they didn't know how bad. They particularly didn't know.
Well, Vernon would. Those goons wouldn't. But you know what? I didn't even notice that, Ken. That's a good point. But I didn't notice it. So it may have been a trick of perception, depth perception. They may not have been as close as you think, because after the explosion and you see the zero matter, the only people there, the immediate area is completely clear except for Wilkes and Whitney.
Yes.
Of course, I guess in a nuclear blast, you're not supposed to be, like, within 9 miles of it.
Yeah, and then there's another scene that we'll get to where, you know, I had to question if radiation was still in the area because, but you know, I'm jumping ahead, but we'll get to that. I'm nitpicking again, so
I apologize. Well, no, that's all right because let's fast forward. They fire the gamma cannon. It shuts down the portal. Wilkes falls out of the sky. He's in a crater. You see the zero matter crawling under his skin, so whatever has happened has had an effect. Now, to your point about Manfredi and Vernon's crew being too close, so the very next scene is where Jarvis has broken away from Peggy against her orders to go apprehend Whitney Frost to exact his revenge. He pulls up in the car with... Peggy is in the truck behind him. There's nobody else in the area. They pull up and there's nobody else to stop them pulling into the area. And if there were, Jarvis could not do what he does next. And that's walk straight up to Whitney Frost and shoot her point blank 4 times in the chest.
Yep, he does.
He doesn't hesitate. He doesn't think about it. He doesn't...
he's out for blood.
Yeah. As Doc Holliday said in Tombstone, make no mistake, it's not revenge he wants. It's a reckoning. And here we see, you know, the more to Jarvis than what we've seen before. He's gone from the comic foil to a bloodthirsty killer.
Well, yeah, I mean, not even batting an eye, just walked right up and blasted her, you know, and that's something that, you know, we have not seen from this character whatsoever. I mean, we've seen him clumsily handle weapons and, you know, look uncomfortable in situations. This was not the case. This was a man who knew what his target was. And hit his target as quickly and precisely as possible. And then, of course, then we saw the ramifications of that.
It's after he shoots Whitney that Manfredi and his men drive up and they get there and pull their guns on Jarvis and, you know, Whitney is, of course, unharmed. The zero matter has absorbed the bullets or, you know, she's, you know, healed herself, whatever. And she says, no, I want them alive. And so they're, you know, hit over the head. And that's where this episode ends.
Okay. Yeah. Again, nuclear bomb. I guess we're just supposed to assume that the dark matter hole maybe that opened up, but
it absorbed the radiation. There's no radiation.
Yeah. So I guess that is just supposed to be assumed. But there's something that Thompson says later in the second episode. I don't know. Like I nitpicking. You know, there's more important things going on, but that's just. You know, I look at every little detail sometimes.
What I would say, though, and I think we're getting very accustomed to and a little blasé about special effects, but I really like those special effects. Both the rift, when it opened up and when it was this sort of orbiting black hole in the sky, and then when they shot that gamma cannon, I thought, hey, this is really cool. I wish I watched, you know, I go back to my childhood when
you know, the special effects were like puppets, right?
Well, but
you know, Thunderbirds or that, something like that. It's like, wow, this is they did a good job.
But it's still they were state of the art special effects, but they still had that feeling, didn't they? Of that Thunderbirds, that Tom Corbett Space Cadet, feeling.
Yep, they did.
And they did. Obviously
they're
intentional.
Doing a great job with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. It kind of goes back to the first series when the very first, you know, two or three episodes, there was always some gadget that was blowing up, or, you know, it was very diesel punk. In this case, I think we're getting more into like an atom punk. Ray gun gothic almost, right? And I thought that was great. I thought they did a great job.
I was hoping though that the old TV show Hulk fan in me, but I was really hoping that the ray that shot out of the cannon would have been green. Maybe it's just me.
Yeah.
Well. The light, the indicator was green.
Yeah, but
that we'll
see
later on. But
you remember the whole the gamma radiation always seemed to be kind of like this greenish glow, and you know when the old TV show where the lab blows up and the whole place is kind of glowing green, and that's when we see Lou Ferrigno the first time as the Hulk. And there was a little bit of me that was kind of hoping there would be an old nod to what the gamma used to be, which was, you know, kind of like this green kind of radiation.
Well, wouldn't it be cool if this gamma cannon isn't used later on in some of the Marvel Universe movies?
That would be cool.
Yeah. Well, so now it's time to move on to part two. It's all a song and dance, and we open up with a dream sequence that I absolutely loved.
Oh, it was fantastic.
I loved everything about it, going from the black and white to the color, and it being a traditional Golden Age Hollywood musical number.
Oh, it had everything in it. It had Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. It had Sinatra. It had, you know,
Gene Kelly.
Yeah,
yeah, there was a little bit of the Dancing in the Rain feel to it.
Oh,
yeah, and there was the whole film noir
Singing in the Rain
feeling,
right?
Sorry,
yeah. I didn't see you.
Singing in the Rain. Yeah.
It's so hard to do this over Skype. You never know when someone is about to say something. All these conversational pileups. Sorry about that.
Go, Daisy. You take it.
Now,
you're excited. Go.
Because in this sequence, we get to see somebody we haven't seen since season one.
Yes, that is true.
We see a lot of people who've been important in Peggy Carter's life.
That's
and
right.
In this scene, when everything turns into color, you see a sign for the automat. And I got so excited when I saw that sign, because I knew that meant we would be seeing, even though it's a dream sequence, we got to see Angie again.
Yeah.
Well, and how apropos, because Angie... you know, fancied herself as an actress and
yes.
a musical performer. That was what she was in New York to do.
She was often the one kind of talking to Peggy about her problems, you know, so maybe Peggy just has this subconscious idea that Angie's going to be the one to talk her through this one she's got now.
Yeah. Well, and...
I was a little... I hate to say this, but I was a little sad when I saw that, thinking this is a complete recap of Agent Carter seasons 1 through 2, as if there won't be a season 3.
Yeah.
I got that feeling at the end of it. I thought to myself, they've taken her entire journey. If you think about it, it's a journey. And from the very beginning and arriving in New York and being the second fiddle to the men in the office, and the whole idea about the role of women after the war and you know, all the people that she meets. And then going through, of course, now, it was full of information. I loved the songs, the words. They weren't just, what do you call it, just lighthearted little ditties. This was all telling her story. They were talking about her all the time, about the choices she had to make and her hopes and fears and all this kind of stuff.
Well,
and it kind of shot it at the end of it when it was over. I loved it. I thought it was just one of the. I mean, we think about how it's almost as if you think about the process of script writing. These guys are sitting around in the morning, right? They're hungover from the night before. They've got their coffee and their donuts, and somebody's coming on and says, "Okay, so now we've got Jarvis and Peggy in this truck in the middle of the desert. Everything is monocolor. How are you going to jazz this thing up?" And somebody had to come up with this idea. I mean, it's Emmy worthy how they decided to do this at this point and pack so much information, so much nostalgia, so much color and excitement, and obviously now challenging everybody. Can you imagine being an actor in this program and somebody comes along and says, "Hey, we just written the script for this episode, and by the way, you're singing." Like, what?
Okay.
You're dancing. What?
Okay, so that's an interesting point, Charles. And, you know, it kind of reflects how we as a contemporary viewing audience consider TV movies and our superstars, right, our movie stars. Back in the golden age of Hollywood, everybody
yes.
had to sing and dance.
No big deal.
And you know, it was expected. Today, when we see... what was her name? Anne Hathaway. Give that Oscar award-winning performance in Les Miserables.
Right.
You know, perfect vocals, just awesome, awesome singing. We're like, what? She can sing? Well, of course she can sing. I don't know why we get into this kind of rut in contemporary society that, you know, everyone's just a one-trick pony, but... we do, and I love it when we're reminded that, no, people in Hollywood today are just as talented as people were in Hollywood during the Golden Age. They just don't get a chance to show it as often. And for me, that was no more evident than Sousa's song and dance. He channeled... Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra. It was kind of a combination of the two for me, yeah.
Well, he's got his sleeves rolled up like Gene Kelly would have, and he's wearing the sweater vest. And, I mean, again, he's been one of my favorite characters, but this scene just took it to a whole nother level for me. And what's interesting is we're seeing all of these characters through Peggy's eyes, how she sees them, because it's her dream, right? And when Dottie Underwood shows up in her dream, Peggy asks, "What are you doing here?" And what does Dottie say?
"But Peggy, I'm always be in your head.
Always going to be in your head. Yeah, always be in your head, yeah."
And isn't that
class? Officially went over the cliff on that one.
Yeah.
Well,
this whole thing was classic.
Yeah, well, and those...
I'll have to watch it again.
Those aren't Dottie's words. Those are... Peggy's thoughts about Dottie, and basically in her own dream admitting that Dottie has gotten into her head and under her skin.
And that, sorry, Uber Geek moment, we have seen in another very classic villain / hero play back and forth with the Joker and Batman.
Yeah.
We've seen that where, I mean, and especially, what was the latest Batman game, Arkham Asylum, or the newer one?
Yeah, where the Joker only exists in his head.
Is only in his head, and it's played out as though he's actually there. So, you know, I think what they've done especially with that, is basically say, as we've been saying, especially Charles, is that Dottie is the counterpoint to Carter.
Yeah. And
that segues, that line segued right into Haley's song, Haley Atwell, the actress playing Peggy Carter's song. And I just love the words. What's it going to be? Joy or disaster? Who's it going to be? And then the two men in her life.
It's all about
it was just full of information. Yeah, it was just full of information about her state of mind. And you kind of, I think at that point in time, you knew there was something, you knew she was dreaming, but you didn't really know where and what was going to happen after it. But it was so entertaining. And then my favorite part.
It was mine too.
Yeah. Jarvis in the tux, okay, surrounded by girls that look like pink flamingos.
But they not just any girls, Charles. Pink. Not just any girls dressed as pink flamingos. It was Dottie, Anna,
right,
and Whitney Frost.
Really?
Yeah.
See, it was all going so fast, I didn't even notice.
Let me look at this again.
Whoa!
You have to watch that whole dance routine again and listen to every word and watch all the sequences that they do in drawing her story and drawing all the plot elements, not just for this season, but the season before, tying in all of her interactions with every single character, villain and friend, and then finally coming up with that just before she wakes up, I got this image of Jarvis and the pink flamingos. I thought that was done for me.
Oh, what a great nightclub act that would be. Jarvis and the Pink Flamingos.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the actress that plays Dottie, I was in L.A. during the whole, swing dance revival. She can dance. Like, she doesn't only just show up to run that line. She becomes one of the background swing dancers, and I'm watching her again right now. Wow. Oh, and you're absolutely right. I'm on the scene where they show Jarvis. Holy smokes, I didn't catch who they were right off the bat. Yeah, it's Anna doing the splits. It's Frost to his left and
Dottie to his right.
Yeah, wow.
And the whole number, the whole number ends with Rose saying, "We're sorry, you're not right for the Arbeit theatrical agency," and punching her out.
Oh,
wasn't
man,
that great?
That was just the icing on the cake. I just, that whole scene, I just, my face hurt from smiling so much.
So creative. I mean, it's just a wonder of script writing. And as I said, can you just imagine the group of script writers hung over from the weekend before, walking in and saying, "Okay, guys, now what are we going to do? How are we going to make this a little more entertaining? Oh, yeah, well, we'll just go into a Gene Kelly dance routine and recap her entire life story. Oh, yeah, okay, we'll do that. All right, you write it up."
Well, and, not to kind of derail the conversation, but I wish that TV would see the value in more of this. I know that in recent years, we've had shows like Smash and Galahad and or Gallivant.
I love that show.
And Bunheads, doing a lot of this musical theater stuff. But when you look back and you poll fans, their favorite, like, when you ask people what their favorite episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer was,
I was just going to say this, Johnny.
It's the musical episode. When you ask people what their favorite episode of Xena Warrior Princess is, it's the Bittersweet, the musical episode. And I wish that Hollywood would pick up on this a little bit more and give us more of this in some form or fashion.
Well, friends of mine who I'm going to be spending next, not this weekend, but the following weekend with, at the Wild Wild West Con, the big steampunk con, the League of Steam is a group who do a web series, and they portray steampunk paranormal hunters, and they're third season finale is a musical episode.
There you have it.
Yeah. People love musicals, and the fans love musicals, and you're absolutely right. Hollywood needs to understand this, and this was, I believe, our Agent Carter, little bit of a musical episode.
This will be a fan favorite.
Yeah.
And I hope it delivers the ratings that's needed to pull, we don't really know what's going to happen next year, but, clearly the originality and creativity they've employed in this entire run, season one and two, has really set a new standard for witty, intelligent, fun, great acting ensembles. They've got a lot of really great serious actors that play all kinds of roles melded into one, and I just hope they get another chance to keep it running.
Yeah. Well, so after the dream sequence, they wake up, they realize they're in the truck. We flash to the scene on the hill, Thompson looking out with the binoculars, scanning the horizon. And Samberly pipes in and says, "They are going to come back and pick us up, aren't they?"
That's our Samberly.
And they don't realize, none of the three of them realize that they are kind of out in the middle of nowhere, that Jarvis and Peggy have been abducted. And who shows up? Conveniently. Vernon's goons, and Thompson knows why they're coming. He sees them off in the distance. He knows who they are. He knows what's about to go down, and they whip up a plot very quickly to avoid being executed by these two guys. And, it was pretty obvious to us, the viewers, what was going on. But, Charles, you've touched on this a couple of times with, Thompson being this kind of ambiguous, we don't know where his loyalties mm-hmm. fall. We know that this is a plan, but then there's something in the back of your mind that goes, but is it really?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
You're never quite sure about him.
Exactly. It's well played by him as an actor, too. He delivers. He gives us that feeling that we're not really quite sure which line he's going to fall on, which side of the fence he's going to fall on.
Yeah, and he's made himself look like he's the prisoner of Sousa and Samberly, and he convinces the goons that Vernon wants those guys alive, and that if they shoot him, Thompson, that Vernon's going to have their heads, and he influences them, he convinces them, and just as a parting shot, just to prove the point that he's still on Vernon's side to his goons, he gives Sousa a nice solid punch in the gut.
Yeah, and he tells him later, "Well, I had to do that to sell it." Oh yeah, right.
Yeah, I think
that's something that, he's that wanted point, to do for a while anything.
Yeah, I agree with you, Daisy. He's wanted to do that for a while. Yes, it was to sell it, but he got some pleasure out of it as well. Now, I did find it awfully convenient in the next scene that Peggy just happened to have a hot wire in her belt. Now, is that standard issue? Is that something she has in every belt?
For Peggy, yes. It's a necessity for her.
I want one of these, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
This reminds me of the very early James Bond, not later on where some of the gadgets that Q gave him were really complicated, but right back in From Russia with Love, he had this briefcase. And in this briefcase, there was everything a secret agent needed. There was a dagger that came out of the thing.
the one side. There was a strip of gold coins. There was, you know, hidden gun. There was all. And so, to me, this is just standard secret agent issue. You know, you've got a belt on. Why waste the opportunity? Put a hot wire in there in case you need to saw through some stainless steel. Why not?
Yeah, I thought that was you know, a really good thing that they did there, because, and, you know, as Charles pointed out, it was very James Bondish. And I think the way that they've kind of, at least recently, betrayed like the SSR is not so much secret agents, almost like another like FBI kind of type group, and we tend to forget that no, these are supposed to be, you know, the SSR is supposed to be the, you know, the elite. They're the forefathers to S.H.I.E.L.D. And having that little reminder with Peggy whipping out, you know, a device out of her belt is a nice little reminder that no, these are supposed to be the top elite spies. These are the guys that, you know, go in and.
Yeah, to me obviously it's a device to keep the plot moving forward, because how else, you know, we've always said she's not a superhero. She's not going to do it with her eyes, you know, like an X-Man, or strength like a Superman. So she's got to have something. And this was a great way to move it forward. And it was actually more explainable, if you think about it, than the little telex from Howard Stark with the design specifications. This is something that you believe it. The believability factor was really high. Oh, yeah, she'd have that in her belt.
Look at Charles pulling out the X-Men and Superman references.
Nah, there you go. I can be a geeky kind of guy if I want to be. Sure. Yeah, I was reading those comics before you were born, Ken. I got to tell you. The originals. I had all the originals. My mother gave them all away. Right from number one. Just a bunch of papers that needed to get thrown out at the end of the day. Never mind. But we, you know, this is what this series is all about. It's about the unexpected. And, you know, they move the plot forward very fast. There's no, you know, pauses that sort of like, okay, yeah, somebody do something, somebody say something. They really move this story along at a breakneck pace, especially this season, I think. So where do we go after this? So we're back in the car with Whitney and Wilkes, and Wilkes is starting to, I don't know what happens to his internals, but this Zero Matter is sort of like, you know, he thinks it looks like somebody who's kind of overeaten, and he's about to explode.
Right, and that's what
his eyes go black.
Right.
And they discover that Peggy's escaped. And then once they discover Peggy's escaped, we know they're going to have to go back for them. And so we flash into a scene with Peggy and Jarvis walking in the desert, and there's an argument. And it's really kind of interesting because each one argues about the other, what the other one has done or said to them in the past, and then they turns on them, right? Maybe Ken, you've got the details of some of the conversation, but I thought that was quite interesting. You've got two people in the middle of nowhere, but actually what they're saying is really the focus, and what they said was really well scripted, I thought.
Well, the what's interesting is out of all of this with the two episodes, I almost found this scene between Carter and Jarvis, this bothered me, you know, because we had had all this build up, with Frost being evil and the amount of death by her literal hands that she's caused, the you know, the fact that Jarvis rolled in and, yeah, basically shot her point blank. The anger by Carter almost seemed
implausible.
It seemed very misplaced.
That's one thing I would fault. The dialogue and the resolution was good, but the premise was not necessarily correct. And the idea is that, like, this is a woman who isn't even human anymore. And she has the power to destroy the world. Who wouldn't want to shoot her? And who wouldn't be given a medal if she died?
Well,
yet there was some comment about Jarvis being a cold-blooded killer or something.
I wrote that in my notes.
Yeah, I didn't like that part.
Well, I mean, look, they're both incredibly frustrated.
Yeah, and they both make good points about the other.
Well,
they end up seeing a little more eye to eye.
Yeah, you know, they say things that they maybe think in their thoughts, but they don't really feel in their hearts. You know, it's just the heat of the moment. We've all had these times where we say things that we wound a friend because we say the things that are true and that are obvious, but that because we're friends, we overlook about each other. And here, you know, they've let their frustrations in the situation, in each other, get the better of them. And, you know, Peggy realizing that she said some terribly hurtful things to Jarvis, he said some terribly hurtful things to her. You see it on their faces, and they, you know, they reconcile there at the end. But, you know, we see in the scene, Peggy has to let some of that military intelligence officer come out a little bit and give Jarvis some tough love. That's what I got out of it.
I get the point. You know, I definitely get the point. You know, with the tough love and, you know, the fact that he did act. And, I mean, he reacted instead of acted as
well. He disobeyed orders.
Right. But on the same token, we've seen Peggy do the same thing. You know, we we'll actually see that happen in a little bit where she just, you know, goes straight for the throat. And I don't know, I understood where they were going with it, and, you know, the part where Peggy turns and basically, oh, gut-wrenchingly basically tells Jarvis, you know, he gets to go home and spend time with his wife who did survive, and this has all been a lark to him. This is just some grand adventure and everything like that, and how she's actually paid the price 100 times over. I get that, and it was good drama, but on the same token, the initial anger, I guess that's what I'm getting at. The initial anger seemed almost, after everything they've been through, I would have thought Peggy would be a little bit more understanding that, you know, this evil broad nearly killed this man's wife. What man on the face of the earth wouldn't, you know, want to plug somebody who did that to someone that they themselves have risked everything, they have thrown their military career away for them. You know, I don't know. It seemed it was a tough scene. It was a tough scene for me.
Well, it was supposed to be a tough scene. We were supposed to be as frustrated at this point as they are. And, you know, it was kind of a cathartic moment, not just for those two characters, but for us as an audience and for the story. Because from that moment, I think from the moment that they have their split and reconciliation in that same conversation, everything starts turning in a different direction.
Right. And they get refocused on the task, and there was a sort of bonding, I think, there. When people get down, when they strip away all the pleasantries and the wisecracks and all that, they are truly comrades. This is a very almost a band of brothers type moment for these two characters. And yeah, you're right. We've got to get to a point where the heroine, the protagonist, prevails. And this was the point which she's out there marching, and he's basically saying to her, like, what are you doing? What's the point of marching? And she basically says, our job is to march until we drop dead. Somebody will find us. Something will happen. If we can't make it happen, we'll just let it happen. You know? And that was the point where she's determined to get back on the winning side. And this is where the whole plot's starting to turn to the ultimate, you know, the ultimate resolution.
Right.
So, you know, it's distressing to see it, but I think pin the word correctly, it's cathartic between those two, because you know, they have been through a lot. It's again a little sad thinking that maybe they want to end the series, end the Agent Carter story with this being said between them. You know, why say it? You know, I think that's what Ken's point is. Why say it? Well, they're saying it maybe because they won't get another chance.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, they both feel like the frustrations just come to a head. I mean, they're hot, they're tired, they're getting nowhere with what they are trying to accomplish. It just kind of exploded, you know, and you said things that you regret or that you wouldn't normally say. But you know how it is, you know, fifth day of a road trip, the air conditioner's out and everybody's tired and grumpy and, you know.
Fifth day, fifth hour. Well, so the two of the goons drive up in the van. They think they're going to reapprehend our escapees, and we get to see what Peggy's really made out of once again, because she just unleashed on this dude. And not in a skillful way. It was just pure rage. It was a thing of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And well,
she's now getting the upper hand. That's where we're going. She's got to come back. They've been down long enough.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying anymore. Is this scene is a turning point. And then we flip over to Sousa and Samberly in jail. Thompson sitting outside the jail cell, and in comes Vernon. Now, I thought this was really interesting, guys, because we know that Thompson is setting up Vernon, that he's playing the part of the heavy for Vernon's edification to, you know, trick him to get the upper hand. But Vernon has suddenly changed his tune about Whitney Frost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you guys think that he always had this in mind as soon as he found out about the Zero Matter, that he would agree that she needs to be taken care of? Or do you think this is just now a new revelation?
I will be honest with you. I think Hughes, from the moment he saw what Frost could do, even though he schmoozed her in the council office, right, was already calculating in his head. And we know that Vernon basically works for Hughes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, this is the council of nine that's now the council of four, or however many people got zapped in that conference room by Whitney Frost, deciding that, you know, obviously just putting a few dog collars around her was not the right answer. You need a gamma cannon.
Yeah, and so...
So...
Yeah, and so now they're going to turn it on her.
I wonder, do you think they contacted Tony Howard Stark?
No.
Wait a minute.
How did that specification come in right at that very moment? If somebody didn't go to them and say, look, we know we're the bad guys and we know which side, you know, we're on, but, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Can you please give these turkeys some weapon to get this girl? Because, you know, all we got is dog collars.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, that's not a bad point, Charles. That's a good observation.
Geek moment.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's good. I like it.
By the way, did anyone catch what Vernon called Sousa?
No.
Called him Andy Hardy. Anyone know who Andy Hardy is?
Yes. He was a junior detective crime fighter.
He was played by Mickey Rooney, and he was basically the epitome of the, like, all American, you know, good boy.
Good boy, yeah. He and I think Judy Garland was in a lot of those movies.
But yeah, basically, the Andy Hardy stories followed Andy Hardy and his family, and they were basically, it was like a sentimental comedy type series of movies that, you know, celebrated ordinary American life. And I thought it was really, really interesting that, and again, attention to detail, throwing out a reference that, like, I had to look up, you know, because I was like, I know that name from somewhere, but. You know, what a great reference to throw out that, you know, unless you were a fan of the movies of that time, you know, I thought that was a nice little thing there.
Well, you know,
they do that a lot.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked about that before. Charles and I, you know, as writers, you always throw something in for the highbrow audience, you know. It's something that only a small percentage of your audience or your readers will understand and get. And when they get it, it's an extra icing on the cake for them. They're like, oh, that's so cool. For the rest of the audience, it's inconsequential. If they get it or not, it doesn't add or take away any of the enjoyment. But for that one percentage, for that small percentage, it's just that extra attention, like you notice, Ken, that makes you go, oh, Andy Hardy.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you get that sense of satisfaction. Yeah, it's good stuff. So they've taken Wilkes to an abandoned waste management facility. It's not a dump.
No, he's very insistent about that.
It's a waste management facility. And you know, I love this, that, you know, Manfredi is so apologetic that he's not able to give Whitney a proper laboratory. And she's like, hey, it doesn't matter. You know, I can do my work anywhere. And she's the one who's really showing some gratitude to him. And I don't think she's shown gratitude to anybody. Sincere gratitude.
Yeah, these two are definitely two peas in a pod. Again, you know, like we've discussed, it's making the villains kind of likable. You know, I mean, you hate them. Yeah, you know, they're obviously maniacs and psychopaths and whatnot, but. Gosh darn it, those two kids are just the cutest things ever.
Well, you know, here's the difference, okay? I couldn't wait to see Chadwick get his, right? I couldn't wait, or maybe I still can't wait, to see Vernon by the farm. Season one, I couldn't wait for Dr. Ivanko to get taken out. I hated those characters. I hate those characters. Whitney and Manfredi, you know, I have some mixed emotions about how their end is going to come. Yes, I know they need to be stopped. I know that, you know, Whitney Frost is psychotic, maniac, but there's part of me that doesn't want to see her die. I just want to see her lose her powers and go to jail.
Ain't going to happen. But yes, you're right. Yeah, they've given us a lot more dimensions to the antagonists than what they did in season one. Even Dottie's kind of one dimensional. I mean, and it's in the sense that we don't really know what her feelings are. You know, she's a psychopath and she's a deadly killer, but these are two that have actually got personalities deeper than their obvious roles in the scheme of things.
Yeah. So anyway, Whitney's trying to extract zero matter from Wilkes because he's full of it now. And you know, we leave the waste management facility with that giant needle stuck in his chest. He's fighting against it. He's fighting to contain the zero matter inside of him. And we're going to find out why in the season finale. But when we come back after commercial break, Peggy is storming into Vernon's office.
And this is what I was talking about.
And she smacks the crap out of him. Daisy, you had to really dig this scene.
Oh, I did.
Of course, she doesn't know what the plan is. She doesn't know that Jack Thompson is, you know, playing the bad guy. He's really on the side of on their side, and at least Vernon, at this moment, when they come into the lab and Samberly is repairing the gamma cannon or making modifications to it, as we find out later, I think for the first time ever, Vernon is telling the truth. Uh-huh. When he says, you know, we can't let this woman continue down this path with these powers. She is too dangerous.
Right, and it's the joining of forces of the shadow government with the good guys, that the people playing it straight, right? They're the ones that are trying to do the right thing. He's trying to keep the shadow government in power. So let's team up. This is like the conspiracy of conspiracies now.
Well, yeah, and you know, they all have, you know, they all have something on each other at this point. So, you know, like Vernon says, even if you try and take me down, I'm going to take you all with me. So at this point, we might as well just work together and end this. So.
I was thinking of the parallel to that is really the relationship the Allies had with the Russians during the war. Mm-hmm. You know, as soon as that war ended, they were enemies. And that's what's going to happen here, too. But during the, you know, this process, they've got a common enemy. They've got, they're allied. They're going to help each other at arm's length, but still side by side. And so we're getting set up for the final resolution.
Yeah, and speaking of that resolution, in the next scene, you know, Thompson is about to confront Manfredi and Whitney Frost in the waste management facility, but before that, we got this great moment where Manfredi is teaching Whitney Frost a little thing about torture and interrogation. That you can only push someone so far before they break. And once they break, you got nothing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fun scene for me to see Manfredi show that human concern, but not really concern for the person, but concern for the process.
Right. And he may be a psychopath, but he's a professional psychopath.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I mean, there's a right way and a wrong way. It's not going to be random and brutal and gory. It's going to be planned. You got to take your time. I mean, come on. This is serious business. It was great.
I also like the part where, you know, you see Frost getting more and more frustrated with Wilkes, that they have tried several different means by which to extract the dark matter, and he's just not giving it up. And he's basically telling them, listen, I'm dangerous. You don't want this. This is going to kill you. And she's just so driven, you know, to take the rest of this dark matter. It was very interesting to see, you know, and terrifying at the same time, because you realize that Wilkes is a ticking time bomb.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, he really is, and we're gonna see some of that here at the end of this episode, but. In comes Thompson. He strolls into the waste management facility. And did anyone pick up on this when he's having this exchange? You know, Whitney says, hey, you're very brave or very stupid. He says, yeah, a little bit of both. But she knows about the cannon. She asks him because she knows that Masters, you know, Vernon Masters has sent him. Or he volunteered, he said. But she says, where's my cannon?
Right. Well, I mean, Vernon even says back at the lab that she's been out, she was expecting it an hour ago. So he's already informed her about the cannon.
Okay. And I missed that part.
Yeah, and Vernon was initially going to go and, you know, give her the update that the cannon was being fixed. And then was going to be delivered to her, but it was Thompson who volunteered to go in Vernon's place. And we find out why in the scene.
So let me ask this question. He reveals his intentions to Whitney Frost. Mm-hmm. He's going to get Vernon out of the way. Mm-hmm. And in exchange, he wants a seat on the council.
Right.
Is he being sincere here?
Well,
or is he playing Whitney?
Who knows? Thompson's kind of hard to get a read on.
Well, we find out later in the episode exactly what his intentions are. He's basically playing Vernon and Frost. So basically what he's done is he's betrayed Vernon by telling Frost, oh, by the way, Vernon is going to deliver the cannon to you, but then he's going to use the cannon on you. I'm here to tell you this. And at that point, that's when Whitney's like, well, what do you want? You want his job? And he's like, oh no, I want something much bigger than that. I want a seat on the council. So what he's doing is he's betraying Vernon to win over Frost to get the Frost.
But do you think he...
As a good guy or as a bad guy?
You see, that's my question.
He's doing it... Okay.
And does he really want a seat on the council?
No. No, because as we see when they go to leave with the cannon, and Sousa and... Carter's car has been sabotaged. They think at first it's Vernon that has sabotaged the car in order to betray Thompson. But Samberly comes out and says that he's made the modifications per Sousa's request. And they're like, what are you talking about? And it's like, well, it's a bomb.
No, per Thompson's request.
Well, yeah, he says that Thompson tells him to do it, but says it's Sousa's order. So Thompson has basically gone kind of white knight rogue, in that this is my thought on this. Thompson is actually trying to protect Sousa and Carter and Jarvis and Samberly and all these other people. He's going to try and take on not only Frost, but he's also going to take on Vernon and eliminate two birds with one stone.
Yeah, I'm watching this scene again. They've just taken off in the truck, mm-hmm. and Sousa realizes the fuel line on their car has been cut, so they can't follow for backup. Runs into the office. He's figured out our plan. What plan? You know the plan. This is Samberly talking. Mm-hmm. And turning the gamma cannon into a bomb. Yeah, and Sousa says, who told you to do that? Chief Thompson.
All right, and he says, because isn't that what you ordered?
Yeah, and but Sousa says no.
Right.
So Thompson has played everybody right here.
Yep. But I think the reason why Thompson has done it is because Thompson is, in his mind, still the big white knight who needs to ride in and save everybody. We saw this play out kind of in season one. You know, because he comes off as a complete jerk, but deep down inside he cares about those, you know, he cares about his agents. He cares about, as much as he gives Sousa grief, it's like a big brother. You know, the fact that he went to Carter first with the file instead of going directly to Vernon, he was trying to warn Carter. Even we've seen this played out.
I'm leaning with your argument, Ken, and the moment that I think clinches it is, you know, his plan would have worked except for one reason, and that is they decide that he's turned. They decide that they're going to block the detonator that he's got, and he walks out of the factory and pushes on that detonator. And if you think about it, if that had not been blocked, it's game over. It's the end of the show, because they would have blown up both Vernon and Whitney Frost, the council on one side and the big bad Zero Matter gal on the other, and he's done it. His plan worked. So I think he is doing it for the right reasons.
He's doing it the right reasons. He's doing it the wrong way, because even at that point, Carter is like, what about your moral code? You're going against your moral code. That's why we can't allow you to do this. They understand. Mm-hmm. But in a twist, Carter then tries to save Thompson from himself. That, you know, you don't have to go it alone. And this is what Thompson has been doing for almost two seasons. He's been going it alone. Whereas, like, you have Sousa and Carter, and their ragtag team, it's always been pretty much Thompson on his own. You know, just trying to do what he feels he has to do to actually protect them.
Yeah, it's a very, very clever, very complex plot twist. We're now at the end of the second episode before the finale, and we still don't know about Jack Thompson. And you know, the thing about it is he's switched sides so many different times. He's done so many different things that have questioned his loyalty to the Carter team and his ability to side with the Vernon team, that we don't know if he's playing us. He's playing the audience now. We really don't know what he's going to do next.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Well, it is, because think about this. So he could have detonated this cannon, taken out Vernon and Whitney at the same time, and gone to take his seat on the council, having knocked off the king and the queen off the chessboard.
Right.
So, yeah, that's why I'm still not sure if there's any altruistic motives here at all.
Well, I mean, Vernon isn't really... Vernon is more a knight than a king on the chessboard. Vernon is...
Well, he thinks he's a king.
Right, he thinks he's a king, but he's still being controlled by the council. What Thompson's point is that unless he stops all of them in one swoop, inevitably Carter and her team are going to have to keep dealing with either Frost or Vernon. And then there's the whole idea that they're not sure, you know, even though Carter believes that Wilkes is under the influence of dark matter, you know, there's the belief that now Wilkes has turned. And Thompson's tactic is just to take everybody out, and I think we are going to be surprised that Thompson has actually been the good guy this entire time. And even when, like last season, when we were accusing him of possibly being Hydra and all this other stuff, I think he's been that wild card that has been playing both sides, but ultimately was doing so to protect Carter and the SSR.
Maybe he's the one that's in contact with Howard Stark. Maybe he was the one that ordered the procured the specifications.
That's very possible.
He wasn't in that scene. That scene was, you know, in terms of, like, he'd only come back from England with the file.
Oh, but wait. So that information comes in on Stark's
telex.
And who is sitting right in that same room after they come back out?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thompson.
Yeah, we're going to. Yeah, this isn't resolved yet. We've got enough to argue one side or the other, and that's been a deliberate plan to keep us guessing until the very end.
Well, yeah,
I would not be surprised that the reason why Thompson keeps showing up in Stark's home is, like you said, Charles, is that Stark and Thompson are working together.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Because if you think about it, his tactics, his like lone wolf tactics,
much more explainable than having the council do an about face and work with Stark. I mean, that's a possibility, but unlikely.
I still think those portraits have eyes.
Oh yeah. What I was going to say though is that if you think about it, Thompson's lone wolf tactics are very much in the same kind of way that we've seen other Starks act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'm on board with that yet, but. You know, I did just rewatch that scene while you guys were talking where Thompson comes out. He's trying to get the detonator to go, and he's justifying his actions. You know, they're like, you know, you're going to kill Wilkes too. And he's like, look, Wilkes is more dangerous than Frost and Masters combined. The three of them have got to go. And he, at a gunpoint, he has Samberly turn off the jammer for the transmitter, and we see the light. The bomb light back up on the gamma cannon as Vernon's being turned slowly into zero matter. He's about to meet his end. And then all of a sudden, before the bomb can go off, before Vernon can be killed, Whitney realizes, you know, she's got to get out of there. But the door is blocked by Jason Wilkes coming into the room, his body cracked with zero matter. And then, spoiler alert, he just explodes. All of that zero matter oozes out of those cracks and just explodes towards Vernon and Frost, and the screen goes completely black.
And we all need to catch our breath.
Yeah, and even before that, though, we have Wilkes basically sacrifice himself and lock Carter out of the building in order to save her, even though she's come to rescue him. And, confesses, when I pulled the shotgun on you, that was me. That wasn't Dark Matter, because she's been trying to justify it. And he's like, no, that's me. And, in the classic, seeking reconciliation for his actions, he locks her out and heads in to stop them all.
So this may seem as a very strange comparison, but it just occurred to me. With Thompson, with Wilkes, Carter, everybody else involved, the heroes of the story, they're all doing the right thing, in essence. They're doing the right thing. Some of them are hard choices, like Thompson, but at the end of the day, they're doing the right thing, and this final scene actually in some ways reminds me, and this is the odd comparison, but maybe you can see it, reminds me a little bit of the final scene of Casablanca, where everybody does the right thing, but the right thing wasn't necessarily what the audience wanted to happen. Does that make sense, Charles?
Oh, it does. Yeah. I mean, this whole thing has been designed that way from the very beginning. We've got a real, what's interesting is the backdrop. It's Hollywood. This has almost been a homage, a retrospective of everything great about that entire era in Hollywood, not in terms of the stars and their real lives.
I'm on headset. What? Produced,
the kinds of
I'm finishing up recording right now. What do you need?
The love scenes.
Well, come here. Talk to me. Don't yell at me.
Amazing stories and the old-time sci-fi. That, as you said, there's Casablanca coming to play, the Gene Kelly dance routines. It's built up to that point. And we now have one episode left where we've got to put, everything into a bowl. Everything's got to come together. It's great.
I
just think they've done such a wonderful job throughout the whole of the two series so far, and the tension to detail,
we're talking about
the set designs,
2 hour long
episodes, consistently great. They haven't stumbled.
Yeah, it's good stuff, and there is a lot to resolve in one episode. It'll be a roller coaster ride for sure. Well, believe it or not, guys, we have been talking about these two episodes now for 2.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for our listeners, we probably need to go ahead and call it a night. But before we do that, any last thoughts about these two episodes, Ken?
Well, like Charles just touched on about how, this has been such a homage to, the old Hollywood great movies, just in that opening scene, with the whole, the dance routines and the songs and the fact that we went from a black and white film noirish kind of scene with Peggy and her brother, I thought it was really interesting that the color that comes in is green, which for some reason reminded me of the Wizard of Oz when that went from black and white to color.
I think that was intentional.
Yeah.
Getting her own
scene. And I think that whole dance routine in itself was an homage to, to Hollywood and its, the old Hollywood that we loved, with the going from black and white to color, you know, yeah, we've pointed out little hiccups and things here and there, but man, you know, this is the type of TV that so many of us who grew up, you know, watching, you know, old black and white movies or our grandparents sharing with us, you know, Saturday afternoon movies that they grew up with. This is the type of TV that we sorely, sorely miss. And I really, really deep in my heart hope that this is a sign to Hollywood that you can return to this. You can bring back old classic Hollywood in all its glory by giving good content and good storylines, and it doesn't have to be you know, one reboot after another. You can come up with good stories and do it classic and beautiful, and I really hope that, you know, there's a part of Hollywood that pays attention to this.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see. We'll definitely be talking about that on our final episode when we talk about the finale, because there's a lot of meat and potatoes there to digest and dissect, and we'll save that conversation for our final episode. Daisy, your last thoughts on these two episodes?
Well, yeah, I know I've been letting a lot of the others do the talking because they took all the notes and everything, but these past two episodes have been probably some of the most riveting ones I've seen maybe this season, maybe in the whole series. I mean, I was physically reacting to some of the stuff we saw. It was some heavy stuff, and I can't wait to see, you know, what becomes of all this pile up of plots and pile up of just all these schemes, and who is really on what side. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Absolutely. Ken, or Charles, rather, your final thoughts?
I couldn't say it any better than Ken and Daisy. They're both absolutely right. Two of the best hours of production value and content that this series and the previous series have had. Fabulous acting, fabulous entertainment, good special effects, a plot that's so twisted it would, you know, makes a pretzel look like a pencil, straight as an arrow. You know, this has just got us all wanting to know what's going to happen next.
And, you know, I'll add to that, because I was thinking about this as I watched these two episodes. You know, we've got a series here that has a lot of twists and turns, a lot of ups and downs, comedy, drama, action, adventure, but it doesn't take itself too seriously, and this show is accessible to all ages. This is a show that a family could sit down and watch together, and there's not a lot of that on TV anymore, and it's something that I really love about this series.
Yeah, it's not needlessly trying to be edgy for edgy's sake.
Yeah, and it's not over, you know, it's not gratuitously violent. You know, the violence that is here is, you know, moves the story along. It's consequence of the story. And to just piggyback on what Ken and Daisy and you've said, Charles, you know, I do think when I'm watching the show, it makes me a little bit sad that I think we've lost something in American entertainment. Mm-hmm. And this show, to me, proves that you don't have to be rated R to be entertaining. And you don't have to be rated R to have, you know, audiences sit on the edge of their seat. You don't have to use gratuitous sexuality, violence, language, you know, sick twisted, psychopathic plot lines. And yes, we have psychopaths in the show, but, you know, they're not like, you know, it's not like a Criminal Minds or, you know, CSI type of show.
They're entertaining. They're friendly psychopaths.
Yeah, I mean, it's
amusing psychopaths.
Yeah, it's psychologically thrilling. They don't have to, you know, cross the line, and it's something that I really like about this show, and something we're going to talk more about on the finale. But all in all, I agree with you guys. For me, the song and dance number at the beginning of It's Just a Song and Dance is one of the highlights of the series, and one of the highlights of recent television for me. Really just a great scene, and one that I think will be a fan favorite for a long time. Well, for all of you listening, we're going to, next week is the finale broadcast on Tuesday night. We will not be covering it until the 10th. So don't think that we've left you hanging. There are some Ken and Charles are going to be out of pocket, and so we've decided that we're going to just take a week off. It'll just make it better, because it'll give us more time to analyze and really put together our thoughts on the finale. And, you know, with the way TV is now, the majority of people watching Agent Carter right now are not watching it live, meaning during its broadcast time slot on Tuesday nights. The majority of people are watching this on demand through Xfinity or Hulu. And so even though we're going to delay our analysis of the finale for a week, there will be a lot of people who will just be catching up. So I think that'll be just fine. I want to remind you guys listening to make sure you drop us a note. Let us know what you think of our analysis. Let us know what you think about Agent Carter. Feedback@dieselpoweredpodcast.com. Whether you use iTunes or Stitcher or listen to the show through our RSS feed, however you do it, do us a favor. Go to iTunes and go to Stitcher and post a 5-star review. Let folks know what you think about the show. Post a positive review. That helps us out. And don't forget to visit our sponsors. Once again, Audible is one of our sponsors. And you can get a free audiobook on us. Over 100,000 titles from Audible just by checking them out on us at audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast. Over 100,000 books, a lot of cool pulp and diesel punk books out there as well. Just go have a ball, find one you like, and on checkout, you'll get it free just for checking it out if you go to audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast. Well, guys, that's it for this week. I appreciate you guys joining me and talking about this. I can't wait for the season finale next week, and then our analysis 1 week later. And until the next time, on behalf of Ken Sharkey, Daisy O'Dare, and Charles Cornell, this is John Pica saying swing hard, swing often, and we'll catch you on the flip side.